From Capital Public Radio in Sacramento, this is Insight. I'm Jeffrey Callison. Coming up, a Mexican lawyer and law professor talks about his efforts to help reform Mexico's judicial system. Plus, the woman who wrote and made famous the song lyric, I Might Like You Better If We Slept Together. It's Deborah Ayal, formerly of new wave band Romeo Void, now back with new songs. First, local governments are still in financial trouble, including Sacramento County. This week, we heard an astonishing sum from county officials, $166 million. That's the current projected budget shortfall for next fiscal year. How does Sacramento County plan to deal with such a huge shortfall, especially in light of big cuts that have already been made? Joining us with all this is Ben Adler, Capital Public Radio news reporter. Ben, welcome back to Insight.
Good morning, Jeffrey.
Well, first of all, give us a snapshot of some of the bigger or more dramatic cuts that are being talked about at this point.
The thing about making budget cut round after budget cut round is the low-hanging fruit, as everyone likes to say, is gone, and you're really at the bone. And the list of what's here reads kind of like a horror novel. You've got the elimination of adult field services from probation and a reduction in juvenile field services, as well as the closure of the Sacramento County Boys Ranch, which is a juvenile facility. In Child Protective Services, a department already reeling from layoffs and grand jury reports accusing it of incompetence, but trying to turn things around. They've already lost a bunch of people. Dozens more could go. In parks, you're going to see closures of parks and more cutbacks on maintenance. Some parks, at least one I know of, F.E. Yaw, could be privatized and go to a foundation. And also about two-thirds of the parks rangers would be gone. In HHS, Health and Human Services, you've got a lot more clinics closing. For the district attorney, the inability to prosecute some felonies and many misdemeanors, and the sheriff, big reductions there. The list goes on.
That's an astonishing list. How realistic is it? Will all these cuts actually be made?
Well, the reason that's such a good question is because a lot of times you'll get department heads, and I'm sure this is true at other counties and at cities and at the state level and the federal level, but you'll get department heads proposing the worst, scariest outcomes to try to get sympathy from the public and votes from the Board of Supervisors. And I asked the interim county executive of Sacramento County, Stephen Zaley, about that yesterday, and here's what he had to say.
It's called Washington Monument, and I don't think so. With what this organization went through last year, I don't think departments are playing those games. Having said that, we're working very closely with them to make sure that's not going to happen. They have to be very careful this year because whatever they put up is likely to be taken and presented as recommendations because, you know, frankly, they know their operations best. So it behooves them to come and work with me to provide the kind of recommendations that, quote, make sense in a bad time.
The kind of cuts that often attract the most attention are to public safety, law enforcement in particular. You touched on those earlier. Those kinds of cuts tend to get a big pushback. Did that happen yesterday?
It certainly did. In fact, the Deputy Sheriff's Union head, Kevin Mickelson, came to the budget briefing for the media, and I caught up with him afterwards and asked him about the $55 million in cuts to the Sheriff's Department. He described what they would mean and gave his reaction.
It is such a high number. It's an unattainable number. For the sheriff to achieve that $54.5 million cut, he would have to completely disband patrol services, completely disband investigative services. We'd have no detectives, and an additional 100 deputies at both of the jails. It's not even attainable. So it's I'm just bewildered as to, you know, what part of the stratosphere we pulled this number out of.
Well, what did county officials say to that?
What part of the stratosphere did they pull that number out of? Here's where it comes from, according to Stephen Zaley, the interim county executive. He says that number comes from taking the overall $165 million deficit and distributing it to each department equally based on how big a proportion, how big a ratio of the general fund that they get anyway. And then he said that necessarily will not, or rather that won't necessarily be how things turn out in the end.
As we start out spreading these cuts across the organization, we start out equitably, and then we see what we can do and what are the impacts on services. When my final recommendation comes out, it won't be equitable across the organization. I don't think that's the right way to do things. It'll be mixed. It'll be a hybrid based upon different ways of doing business, achievable cuts, what's achievable and what's not, and least impact on services. Probation and sheriff and district attorney will take reductions. Will they be as much as what's allocated on an equitable basis? I don't know. We'll see as we work through it.
Now, it's important to note that county officials don't actually tell the sheriff's department or the district attorney's office what jobs, if any, will be cut. They just say, this is the amount of money you're going to get. Figure it out.
And the reason for that is the sheriff and district attorney and county assessor, for that matter, are elected officials, and so they have the power to set their own, you know, to do what they wish with their budgets. However, I do know that Zaley said he was going to work with Sheriff John McGinnis very closely on making the cuts that have the least impact. And, you know, we'll see what happens. Last time, and this was with a different county executive, Terry Shutton, last year, but last time there was talk of basically cutting in half, rather, the number of sheriff's deputies on patrol in the unincorporated areas of the county. And that didn't quite happen when all was said and done. There were reductions, but and other services were cut and shifted, and those deputies were shifted to patrol. But it didn't quite end up as bad as what Sheriff McGinnis and some other, you know, the sheriff's union and others were talking about, or I should say had feared at that time.
Listening to Stephen Zaley there, he's saying that this is just a starting point for negotiations, and there will be a lot of talk. But the shortfall is a shortfall. So if one program is saved, then presumably that means another program has to suffer to make up for that.
It is well past being a zero-sum game at this point, Jeffrey. There's really, if you want to add money back to the sheriff's department, it's got to come from somewhere. In the past couple of years, the county has used a lot of one-time fixes and budget tricks, ranging from reserves, which are, you know, rainy day funds, and that's what they're there for, but they've run out, and then transferring funds from other departments of the county that aren't part of the general fund into the general fund, which is where the discretionary spending is for the county, and then that's going to have to get paid back down the road. They've used up all of those budget gimmicks, and there's no budget gimmick that Stephen Zaley says he's going to recommend this time. He is, you know, the interim county exec. He's got a lot of experience. He came from Alameda County and used to lead the California State Association of Counties. So he knows his stuff, I guess you could say. He knows what's right in his mind. He has an idea of what he wants to do, and that doesn't include one-time fixes anymore. There's only one-time fix that he says he would recommend, and that is any savings with public employee unions that could be negotiated.
We're talking about the huge projected budget shortfall at Sacramento County next fiscal year, over $165 million. The county is now starting to talk about what will be needed to balance the budget, and that will presumably include big cuts to many, if not all, departments. My guest is Ben Adler, Capital Public Radio news reporter. What about labor costs? Has the county been able to rein in labor costs?
Nope. That's a really easy answer. Last year, two unions agreed to some concessions. That was the sheriff's union and the probation union. And in exchange, they had some direct savings on layoffs so for their members. But the other unions did not. And that was, I believe, a disappointment at the time, a big disappointment at the time of county officials. I remember there was an exchange at one of the budget cut hearings where one of the supervisors, I believe it was Susan Peters, asked one of the union representatives, why do you prefer layoffs to furloughs? And the union responded, we feel that at this point, you know, furloughs are not as preferable as layoffs for our organization. And I did try to catch up with the union official later to ask him why they said that, and they declined an interview, so I can't say what was in their mind. But the big question is, what would be different this year? There's a $60 million increase in labor costs alone out of the, you know, $160 million budget deficit. And so why would it be different? I asked Stephen Zaley that.
In all candor, last year was the first time Sacramento County laid anybody off and actually made big reductions. The culture of this county is not unlike some others, but not the way I like to operate. It's the sky is falling in January and we're saved in August. And that didn't happen last year. This year is the same. I think this year they're believing a bit more. So the credibility wasn't there last year. And I don't blame the union reps, because it had never happened before. There's always been a savior. That's not the case now. And I think the bargaining units are beginning to understand that.
Any reason to think that Stephen Zaley will have a better time negotiating with the unions than his predecessor, Terry Shutton?
He thinks so, for one reason. He's not Terry Shutton, he's Stephen Zaley. Left unsaid in that quote, but in my view implied, is that the unions, and I know this from a little bit of reporting myself from last year, the unions didn't like Terry Shutton that much, especially when Shutton basically tried to force mandatory furloughs on unions without going through negotiations. That was a process that we talked about on Insight. When was this? Last fall. And in the end, it didn't happen. It didn't go through. But, you know, Zaley, as I said, has a lot more experience. He's run a couple of counties and he's run the State Association of Counties. And he's clearly running the county budget process differently so far. He's looking at a lot of other things. He's talking about cutting the middle management out, you know, cutting down on middle management. And he is, I think, betting that the unions will trust him.
You mentioned earlier that the county is looking to transfer the Effie Yaw Nature Center along the American River to the management of a nonprofit. Is this part of a general trend that the Sacramento County is looking at, or is that a one-off thing?
It is absolutely part of a trend, and it is something that Stephen Zaley has come into the county saying this is something, I don't know if he'd say he wants to look at, but something that he feels the county is forced to look at. And the county has already moved in that direction in two areas. The first is the Mather Community Campus, which is a program on the former Mather Air Force Base that hosts homeless people, and that has been transferred to the nonprofit Volunteers of America. The county will continue to funnel through funds, I guess federal funds, to that program, but they will not be operating it anymore, and they've taken that cost out of their budget. The same happened with the senior nutrition program known as Meals on Wheels. That happened fairly recently, approved by the Board of Supervisors as well. And they are, you know, Effie Yaw, their last round of mid-year budget cuts in January, there was talk of Effie Yaw being shut down, and the county said, hang on, I think this was kind of at the last minute, hang on, we're not going to do that. Instead, we're going to keep operating it for now, and we're going to start looking for ways to transition it. I think that is something that Stephen Zaley has said you're going to likely see a lot more of in various departments, and not just necessarily nonprofits, but maybe privatizing, maybe combining services with the county. There's been a lot of talk by officials about the animal care department and condensing that with the county. So that's one way that they may get partway, not nowhere near close to $165 million.
And finally, Ben, what happens next with the Sacramento County budget?
Budget hearings scheduled for mid-June. And so that means between now and then, the next several weeks, county's going to be doing three things. They're going to be refining their revenue estimates. So are sales tax and property tax revenues coming in about where they thought they would? Or is the economy bouncing back just enough that maybe there's a little bit more money there than they had expected, or at least certainly budgeted for? Then there's negotiations with labor unions. Are they going to be able to cut down on any of those $60 million in labor increases? Will that help save some jobs? And finally, they're going to be going back to all those cuts that we've been talking about and refining them and working with department heads to try to find the cuts with the least impact. Some of the cuts that I mentioned, perhaps many of the cuts I mentioned, won't be there by the time this is done in its place. Maybe there will be more middle management slimming down. Who knows? But I think to say that there aren't going to be reductions is, you know, and pretty serious reductions would be kind of blind at this point.
And of course, this is not just a Sacramento County story. We also heard this week that the city of Folsom could be cutting up to 50 jobs next fiscal year, and probably no reason to think that other cities and counties are also looking at more big budget and job cuts next year. Ben Adler, Capital Public Radio news reporter, thanks for joining us.
And I'll be back when the city of Sacramento deals with its $30 to $40 million deficit as well. Thanks.
No doubt. You're listening to Insight from Capital Public Radio. Coming up, a top Mexican business lawyer and law professor talks about his efforts to reform Mexico's judicial system. We'll be right back. Listening to Insight from Capital Public Radio. I'm Jeffrey Callison. We welcome your suggestions. Send them to insight@capradio.org. A Mexican commercial lawyer and law professor is in town to talk about needed reforms of Mexico's judicial system. He's Ignacio Gómez Palacio, a Mexico City-based attorney, who is also a former visiting professor at UC Davis. Gómez Palacio's expertise includes investment law and international and national arbitration and mediation. He joins us, Ignacio Gómez Palacio. Welcome to Inside.
Well, thank you very much, Jeffrey.
Your talk yesterday at UC Davis was about reforming Mexico's judicial system. What are the problems you see with Mexico's judicial system?
Well, people don't realize, but a judicial reform has started throughout Latin America in the last, I'd say, 10 years strongly. And Mexico is in great need of joining in. And the reason is that our trials, our procedures are secret and written. Written and secret, confidential. There's, the procedure is all parties, making their arguments in writing and putting together what is, like the Bible there in every trial, which is the file. So, and this is the way matters are decided. Eventually, the judge will come and look at the file and make a decision.
So there's no public cross-examination?
Nope.
Where did that system come from?
Well, the Inquisition.
Really?
Yeah, all right. This comes from, the Inquisition in centuries back. And Mexico and Latin America have followed it. In spite of, being a cry of the French Revolution, copying the Britain open public trial system, and ended up by being established in throughout continental Europe in the 19th century, but Latin America has remained with with this secret written procedures.
So you find trials conducted that way across Latin America?
Oh, yes. Generally speaking, yes. Now, on the other hand, across Latin America, we are starting a change of this system to, open transparency trials.
Who benefits from a judicial system that's both secret and written?
Well, I guess you want to make a list. You can start thinking about corruption. You can start thinking about, lawyers and judges who are not properly performing their jobs. When a judge makes a decision without looking at a criminal or a potential criminal, an accused, that is, without looking at the witnesses, without being right next to the evidence, well, he's earning a salary in dictaminating a file rather than judging. I mean, judges have to be society heroes, where they've been, looking, they look, to the eye, to the accused. And of course, they're risking somehow, revenge. Well, that's what a judge is all about.
My guest is Ignacio Gómez Palacio. He's a Mexican lawyer, former visiting professor at UC Davis Law School. He spoke yesterday at the school's King Hall about his efforts to help reform Mexico's judicial system. Trials are conducted in secret, and the proceedings are handled in writing as opposed to orally. Does this apply to both criminal and civil trials?
It applies to all trials. But mind you, Mexico has amended its constitution 2 years ago to, start oral, public, transparent criminal procedures, and has given a period of 8 years in which the whole matters that need to be taken care will come about, such as amending, the programs of the law schools, teaching professors, and amending the procedural criminal codes of 32 states plus the federal government. And, of course, all the amendments that need to be done within the judicial power. So, and mind you, this constitutional amendment really is the first, which is achieved by society, by NGOs that were put together, a net of NGOs who put a pressure on the House of Representatives and the Senate, and the amendment is in the books. So within 6 years, after all of this has been taken care for, we will have oral, you know, public procedures, and I think it's going to be a great advance.
What do the people of Mexico think about all this? Is this something that weighs on them? Are they pushing for this change in the judicial system, or is the talk about this really more conducted in legal circles?
Well, I would say in general, the legal sectors should not back this. It was backed by society. It was backed by non-legal experts. So
lawyers are comfortable with the system as it is?
I guess, yes, I would say so. And so really this is an appeal, a reach, a push by the society.
Clearly, you see many problems with a judicial system where trials are conducted in secret and through writing as opposed to through oral cross-examination and so on. But if I can ask you to be devil's advocate, are there any advantages to society with a judicial system run that way?
Well, you know, it's a peculiar question, which I seldom have asked myself.
Yes. Well, just in case there's something that we're not thinking of, that I'm not thinking of, that, that could be a benefit to that system.
Well, the benefits would be so minimal, such as, you know, keeping a record. You know, is that relevant versus, you know, proper justice? I don't see that great benefits. And by the way, you know, I'd like to state the fact that the sometimes oral interrogations are performed within this written system, but they end up being done by the secretary of the court away from the judge, and in a not a concentrated way, in which, you know, the witness comes and there is a list of questions that are handled by the parties. And then the secretary to the court makes the questions, receives the answer, dictates it to a secretary, and there is a written document whereby the judge is going to receive information about what the witness said. But this is done like in a hearing today and another one in 6 weeks and another one in 4 weeks, which is not therefore concentrated. So you don't even remember what the other witness said in order to compare, you know, to the answer of one witness.
Does the nature of Mexico's judicial system make it harder to prosecute the drug gangs who are causing so many problems?
No, I don't think. I think there are special laws for organized crime. But I think it's the time is also ready for these people to be, you know, in the public's eye, that we can see them. There are many, many matters which are detailed matters, which I don't think we have the time to get into. And if it's like getting into a detail, is going to take me a while to describe
okay.
it.
Okay, we'll skip that one. Finally, Ignacio, your law firm is based in Mexico City, but your practice involves international matters. Are you involved sometimes in trials in countries that have an open trial system?
Only as expert witness, okay? And as arbitrator. And I must say, I am not, and I've never, you know, made myself look like a criminal prosecutor or criminal expert. I am not. I am an international lawyer, commercial or corporate lawyer as well, but I have been working with society to change the criminal system, the criminal procedure system. Being a lawyer, I obviously studied at law, but I'm not I practice criminal law.
Ignacio Gomez Palacio, he's a Mexican lawyer, former visiting professor at UC Davis Law School. He spoke yesterday at the school's King Hall about his efforts to help reform the Mexican judicial system, which is a secret system, and most of the business is conducted through writing as opposed to orally. Ignacio Gomez Palacio, thank you so much for joining us.
You're very welcome, Jerry.
You're listening to Insight from Capital Public Radio. Coming up, Deborah Ayal, singer and lyricist in the 80s new wave band Romeo Void. She's back with new songs. Stay with us. Listening to Insight from Capital Public Radio. I'm Jeffrey Callison. If you missed Insight, it's okay. Check our archives at capradio.org/insight. It's a classic line from a song, "I Might Like You Better If We Slept Together." The woman who wrote and sang that line was Deborah Ayal of the 80s new wave band Romeo Void. The song was Never Say Never. The band went on to have a bigger hit with A Girl in Trouble Is a Temporary Thing. The band split up many years ago, but now Deborah Ayal is back with a new band and new songs, and she plays a concert tonight in Sacramento. She joins us. Deborah Ayal, welcome to Insight.
Oh, I'm so honored to be here. Thank you very much. I listen to you all the time in the car.
Well, thank you so much. You were, of course, as I said, with Romeo Void. The band split up in 1985. Did you stay active in music in the years between then and now?
Very sporadically, really. I mean, I've gotten a few little bands together and I've, you know, done some shows and done a lot of benefits. I get called for benefits. And Peter Dunn, who I wrote these songs with, and I have been writing together for about 15 years, and he's been real reliable for playing benefits with me.
Yeah.
But I'll have to say that this is a big concerted effort this year to write an album worth of songs with him and get a really stellar band together and get out and play and try to put an album out. It's due by the end of June, Unsettled.
Let's listen to one of these new songs. This is One Saturday Night.
Thanks.
Deborah, it's such a haunting song, the music and the words. What is there a story behind it?
Well, yeah, there's usually a story behind my songs. I take a lot of my material from my life and sort of my viewpoint. Wherever you are, sometimes you look back and wonder, what if? You know, what could have happened? And somehow the chords that Peter gave me, usually he gives me a track with just some chord changes on it, really had that feeling to me of that nostalgia and yearning, kind of. And yet, the instance I was thinking about, the person I was thinking about, I know I shouldn't be with them. That was, you know, a long time ago.
Yeah.
So,
my guest is Deborah Ayal. She's a singer and lyricist. She was founder of 80s new wave band Romeo Void, best known perhaps for the song Never Say Never. Oh, what the heck? Let's listen to a bit of Never Say Never. This is Romeo Void.
Maybe.
Deborah, where did you get the idea for that line, "I might like you better if we slept together"? It's so provocative.
Well, I was having some conflicted feelings, as you can imagine, from the lyrics of the song, but I was really attracted to somebody. So it's kind of like being attracted to poison, you know? It's like, am I going to be more dangerous for them, or are they going to be more dangerous for me? And
did anything happen with that person?
No, and I didn't tell him for over 20 years
that he was the you in in that song.
I didn't, but I was going to have some surgery in the year 2000, and they take you in and warn you, you know, this could be it, you know, kind of thing. Whenever you have surgery. And so I thought before I went in, I'd better call him and tell him. He was surprised, but he was pleased, actually.
I sometimes see the song's title spelled NVR instead of NEVR, Never Say Never. Why is it sometimes spelled that way?
Because Frank Sienkiewicz, who designed the cover art for the EP, he was the bass player in the band, he did that on the album cover. And so usually I'm the one who writes it, NVR, say NVR. I like that. And it was pre-texting that, you know, we used just the
But it's texting
consonants.
Friendly.
Yes.
Deborah Eyal, she was a member of the band Romeo Void in the 80s. The band got attention for that song, but went on to have a bigger hit with another song called A Girl in Trouble is a Temporary Thing. You were on TV with a song.
Yeah, we got to go on American Bandstand.
And it
was
fun.
It was hilarious. It was really good. We were on with New Edition, and which was fun. And they were such young boys then. They were like little babies. And I actually got to make Dick Clark laugh. And when he laughed, his whole body undulated. And I've watched it over and over on tape.
What did you say or do that made him laugh?
I just said, well, we made it to American Bandstand, because he was saying, well, what goes on from here? And I was like, hey, we made it here, you know.
It's such a poppy sounding song compared to Never See Never, which was more typical of the music of the band.
True, but I had fallen in love. And I think by that time I might have even been married. And things, you know, kind of change. Your outlook changes on romance when you have one that's really working.
Deborah Eyal from the new wave band Romeo Void. She is back with new songs and a new band. And tonight she plays Old Ironsides in Sacramento. What did you do in the years, other than occasionally playing music, in the years between the end of Romeo Void and today when you're back in the music biz?
I've been teaching a lot, actually. I started doing artist residencies in San Francisco at the American Indian Charter School, and I had a printmaking studio at the South of Market Cultural Center teaching printmaking. I've been out on the Navajo Nation for a couple of years teaching high school art, and I was there most recently before my husband got offered a job in Sacramento.
And that's how come you're in Sacramento.
Uh-huh. But I was happy to come back to Cali. Absolutely. And, you know, I miss my students and the people I knew in Arizona, the great Navajo people that I met and worked with. But I'm just a California girl at heart.
The sax player in your new band is Dakota.
That's right.
Who's
He's
Dakota?
My nephew.
Your nephew.
Yes. So he grew up playing sax. I wonder why. He grew up listening to Romeo Void, of course. My sister is, you know, my number one fan.
Let's listen to one more new song by Deborah Eyal. This is Stay Strong.
I got on a city bus to find a vacant seat. Dead cold eyes looked past me and I looked down at my feet. A woman slid down next to me. She smelled like fallen leaves. It's her this time, not me, I thought. Unwashed and on the street. There's gotta be a reason I can't finish. finish what I start. There's gotta be a reason why I have this foolish heart.
So, Deborah, tonight you're Old Ironsides. Tomorrow you're at Slim's in San Francisco, which is where Romeo Void came out of. What's it going to be like playing at Slim's after all these years?
Oh, it's going to be wonderful, I'm sure. I have a lot of old friends and fans I'm expecting to run into there, and they have a really good sound and a nice stage. And tonight in Sacramento, it's like a tiny little stage and kind of a little dive bar, actually.
Old Ironside.
Uh-huh. And I'm, you know, to me, it's just like we're going to rock the rafters, you know, and I have a really good feeling about it.
Great. Deborah Ayal, singer, lyricist. She was founder of 80s new wave band Romeo Void, a San Francisco band best known for the song Never Say Never. Also had a hit with A Girl in Trouble is a Temporary Thing. She's got new songs, a new band working on a new album tonight at Old Ironsides in Sacramento, tomorrow at Slim's in San Francisco. Deborah, thanks for joining us.
Oh, I'm so pleased. Thank you.
You're listening to Insight from Capital Public Radio. Coming up, Snap Jackson. It's a bluegrass band that plays with soul. We'll be right back. Listening to Insight from Capital Public Radio. I'm Jeffrey Callis, and we had hoped to bring you violinist Michelle Xiaoyu, who's playing with the Camellia Symphony Orchestra tomorrow, but that had to be rescheduled at very short notice. So what we'll do instead is we're going to listen again to a really fun interview from a couple of months ago with Snap Jackson and the Knock on Wood Players. They're a bluegrass band from Stockton who play with real soul. They are playing in Sacramento the Sunday evening at Maryland's and K. And when I talked with them, I said to Snap Jackson, he's got a pretty snappy name. Is that his real name?
That is not my birth name, no. I was a photo major in college, hence the snap. And
yeah.
Yes.
Where does the name of the band come from, Knock on Wood?
Knock on Wood actually came from one of the songs that you're going to hear in a little bit. I was in another band that was fully plugged in, and it came from my frustration with feedback and cables and microphones. So I wrote a song called Knock on Wood, which is basically talking about going back to the basics of just banging on a piece of wood with some strings on it. And Brian and Shane, I asked them to come over to the house and start playing a few songs with me, and they were so good, I asked them if they would actually be the full-time band members with myself. So we took the Knock on Wood song and turned it into the Knock on Wood Players.
And we'll hear some banging on wood very shortly, but let's just briefly talk first with the other band member, Shane Kalbeck. What do you play?
I play fiddle and mandolin.
And is that what you did before you joined Snap in the band?
Yeah, I played violin since the fourth grade and went to Sac State and was a music major. I actually played viola. And then after college, I decided that I wanted to try to do some non-classical stuff and worked my way that way. And then somehow this fell in my lap, and we've been having a good time for the last year, working on an album and playing gigs.
And Brian Clark, what do you play?
I'm the upright bass player.
Upright bass? Mm-hmm. And you and Shane also contribute vocal harmonies, correct?
We do, yeah. Yeah.
What was your musical background before this band?
Oh, I sang a lot as a kid and studied music at Delta College and UOP, and I've always, you know, done jazz on the side of playing classically, and actually my first experience with bluegrass was this project and kind of learning what that meant to be a bluegrass bass player, and it's been a great journey over the last year. So,
Snap, what's the first song you guys are going to play for us?
The first song is Knock on Wood. And that is with myself on banjo, Shane on the fiddle, or the mandolin, excuse me, and Brian on upright bass.
Well, let's hear it then. It's Snap Jackson and the Knock on Wood Players in our studio. The song is Knock on Wood. awesome. Knock on Wood, performed in our studio by Snap Jackson and the Knock on Wood Players. You know, I'll be frank, you know, a lot of musicians, when they show up to our studios at this time of the morning, they're a little sluggish, but you guys have got so much energy, I can't believe it.
Thank you for all the coffee.
Snap, you write the songs.
Correct.
Have you been writing bluegrass songs for a long time?
I've been writing songs for quite a while, for the last 10 years or so, all in the folk Americana bluegrass genre.
What brought you to this specific type of songwriting?
I started playing the banjo about 4 years ago, and when I picked up the banjo, I started delving into the history of the banjo, which led me to old-time music and bluegrass music, and absolutely fell in love with those two genres. So I pretty much adapted my basic songwriting technique and applied it to the music that I was most interested at the time, which was bluegrass and old-time music.
Why were you looking into the history of the banjo?
Well, I wanted to know what I was a part of and what preceded me, and I tend to do that with most things that I get involved in. I don't know, I picked up the banjo and, to be quite honest, became quite obsessed. So I got my hands on anything possible. I started going to the library and reading about the history of the banjo and listening to bands and other musicians that had played before me, and that just led to all the wonderful, amazing groups that are out there that I latched onto.
Brian, not to get too existential, but you said that you were learning what it takes to be a bluegrass bass player. What does it take? Have you figured it out yet?
Playing fewer notes, to be honest. I mean, coming from a jazz medium and playing every beat and leading chord changes, it's just a different mindset. It actually took me holding myself back, not to play so much, and just keep it simple, and the space, and the patience with it, and picking your spots and learning where in the tunes I can, you know, put a little fill in or call and response, answer back with the other musicians, and that takes time to to do that. So,
and Shane, you're a classically trained violinist. What did you have to learn or change or unlearn?
That's a good question. I had to learn how to improvise. Honestly, they didn't teach me that in school. So
they used to 300 years ago.
But, I know. Music, Bach could improvise,
that
right?
By the way.
But that's honestly the thing I had to delve into, was I didn't know how to improvise. I graduated with a great music degree in performance and composition, but when I graduated, I still didn't know how to improvise.
Snap, you guys are going to play another song for us. What is it?
This song is another original entitled Minor Setback.
Okay, let's hear it.
Thank you. devil strums a melody while all the angels sing.
Snap Jackson and the Knock on Wood Players at Maryland's and K on Sunday. That's Insight. I'm Jeffrey Callison. We'll see you next week.